Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows filling in for this hour, and our technical director is Mike Pritchard. Don Gagne is someone you have no doubt heard if you have listened to NPR News for any length of time. He's covering right now, would it be your third presidential campaign season?
Let's see, 2004, I guess. 2000, but not full-time in 2000. Then okay. All of 04, all of 08, and certainly all of 2012.
Well, Mr. Gagne has gotten very familiar with the Republican candidates along the way in the past years. He's also covered the Bush and Obama White Houses. He got his start in his home area of Detroit, covering the auto industry and related issues back in the 1980s. And he is in town on this day, and I should say now that this show is pre-recorded on Thursday, October 13th, 2011, which means, of course, that we're not able to take your calls this hour. But it also means that anything we talk about concerning presidential politics could change between now and the time this program airs.
It's recorded while the Detroit Tigers are still alive in the playoffs, and let's hope they still are by the time it airs.
I have to be agnostic. I'm sure there are people with views out there. Well, you've been very busy right now following all the Republican candidates out there, and one thing I'm wondering when I see all the news stories that ebb and flow with the campaign is, do you feel that like candidate statements give an accurate picture of what they would actually do? I mean, these candidates are trying to tell us what they would do in the White House. Do the sound bites that get picked up in people's attention, do they really give an accurate picture?
They do not give an accurate picture of what they will be able to do. It is possible, and here's the big cliche, only time will tell if they truly try to put some muscle behind what they say on the campaign trail once elected. But campaign rhetoric and campaign promises are there to give the public a sense of what this person believes, where they're coming from. Of course, the campaigns, carefully develop these plans and choose their words and target this constituency within the Republican family on one day and target this constituency on another day. So there is just always a gap, and it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican, between what you say on the campaign trail and what it's then like once you're sitting in the Oval Office. It's just part of the deal.
Do you feel the candidates are at least giving an accurate portrayal of their intent once they get into office? Or are they, in a lot of cases, trying to push the right buttons with the crowd they're talking to?
Well, they're certainly trying to get votes. And when you're running for office, that is your goal every day, is to try to figure out how to win more support. It's not to say that some of the things a candidate says about taxes or about healthcare or about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan aren't indeed what they would very much like to do. And they may indeed try to do those things once they get in office, but right now it's all about winning over potential Republican primary and caucus voters. That is what it is about at this stage of the game.
Well, there must be part of the challenge for you as a reporter to try to get past the first layer of the stump speeches and the answers given in the debates, to get an idea of what the candidate is about.
Yeah, it's always the challenge. I mean, you want to find out who they are, where they're coming from. So as a reporter at this stage of the – in this stage of the process, you are looking at their record. You're looking at what they've done. You're looking at where they've been. You're looking at how they've lived their lives. You're looking at early jobs they had. You're looking at other public offices that they may or – may not have held, and you are trying to get a picture of who they are, and their proposals are certainly what they want you to think of them, what they want the public to think of them and to see of them. But you always try to look at those proposals and then just apply them to the real world and say, okay, if candidate X is proposing this, given congressional approval that's needed, given budget constraints, given any one of an infinite number of potential variables, you try to both fact check it and imagine how it might play out if they got their way, if they could wave a magic wand and get their way. So you do all of these things. Ultimately, your hope as a reporter is that people who are listening get some better understanding of the candidate, get some better understanding of how realistic what they are saying is, get some sense of how consistent what they are saying is with what they have done in the past, all of those sorts of things. But it's never kind of fully cut and dried on any given day. This happens so you can make your decision thusly.
Well, you know, at this point, I wanted to play a clip from a report that you did recently. And that was from the series that's running on NPR, I think in this case on Morning Edition, called Job One, mm-hmm. in which they're looking in the early careers of one of the candidates. You reported on Rick Perry, who before he became governor of Texas was at one point a farmer, and he didn't just dip his toe in the water. He was a farmer for several years, actually.
A tenant farmer, farming land mostly that he did not own. It was land that his father had farmed before him and at least a good chunk of it that his father and his father had farmed, earlier over the generations. And this series gets to kind of one little part of what I was describing a moment ago. It's a chance to step back, take a long-form look, as we can on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I think this piece ran 7.5 minutes or thereabout, and focus in on one aspect of the candidate's biography, of their work history. And in each case, we didn't pick their first job. We didn't pick their most recent job or their most interesting job. We tried to pick an early job, a job very early in their career that was formative in some way and that has shaped them in some way.
Well, let's listen to just about a minute or so from this report, which goes back to Rick Perry's farming days in Paint Creek, Texas.
This is 72-year-old Waller Overton, another Paint Creek farmer. When I called him, he and his wife, Steffi, were headed out to a remote part of their land to search for some lost cattle that they hadn't seen in almost a month. We drive past miles of red clay farmland, cotton fields, and dry parched grass. And there are gathering rain clouds off in the distance.
I live with this guy and die by this guy. We've had about 3 inches of rain in the last year. It's been really, really a hardship.
Overton has known Rick Perry, who's 11 years his junior, since Perry was a member of a Boy Scout troop led by Overton's father.
What's your sense of what kind of farmer Rick Perry was when he came back here first?
I think he just parked it here for a while. I really do. I don't think he had any intention of ever staying. But when you come back from Europe, or active duty, to Paint Creek, Texas, it's like slamming the brakes on,
And that's just a segment from that particular report about Governor Perry. One thing I noticed about the story, you do hear some clips of him talking about his farming days, but he didn't talk to you about his farming days. Did you try to reach him for the story?
We did not try to do an interview for this story. There were enough things he had said on the record about it. And my goal in this story was twofold. Given that he uses his time as a dry land tenant farmer as one of those key points of his resume and a part of his kind of character building and all of that, I wanted to find out just what kind of farmer he was. What was it like when he was doing that? And it was from the time he got out of the Air Force. He flew big cargo planes for the Air Force around the world, all while based in Abilene, Texas. There's an air base there. But anyway, it was from 1977 when he got out of the Air Force till roughly 1990. So it was about, 13 years, a baker's dozen, I guess. So I wanted to get some sense of what kind of a farmer he was. How good was he at it? How did he take to it? This and that. But then the other thing I wanted to do in the story, and because I found really good sources and interview subjects, was to try to give the public, just our listeners, a little taste of what the job itself is like. So in that clip that we just heard, I'm interviewing Waller Overton, lifelong Paint Creek dryland cotton farmer and rancher, in his truck as we drive around for 4 hours one morning looking for lost cattle, looking for a dozen lost, steer and cows. And I think as we talk, he's looking at the sky and he's talking about how dry it's been and how you worry about it so much. And then we'd kind of bring the interview back around where we'd talk about Perry a little bit. And then we'd drive a little more and he'd be describing, what the cotton balls look like because it's been so dry, and showing me the little traps where the boll weevils, where the conservation office captures them, and, or hopefully doesn't capture any, because if they don't capture any, it means it's not a problem. So we're kind of doing all of that. And ultimately we find a cow and a bull, which is kind of the ending of the piece, which was kind of fun. But I ended the piece by talking about this as being kind of a typical day in the life of somebody who farms in Haskell County. And I noted that it's the kind of day that Rick Perry hasn't had in 21 years since he left this work, since he left the work for something he was more suited to, mm-hmm. politics. So
how do you think that has shaped Governor Perry? You make it sound like it is something, and so did Mr. Overton as well. There's something that that Rick Perry wanted to get out of.
It clearly wasn't his thing. Mm-hmm. And an earlier voice in the piece is a longtime Austin journalist who's covered Governor Perry's entire career and has talked to him at length about this, and talked about, tensions between Perry and his dad, because they're, it's like the farm just wasn't big enough for the both of them. So there was that. Other friends talk about how, it's, if you're not suited to it, it's kind of boring riding a tractor around hour after hour after hour. And that's a lot of what you do. As soon as he got into politics, he clearly found something that was much more suited to his gregarious personality, and he found something he was very, very good at. But what the farming did for him is it gave him some authenticity when he would talk to people in rural Texas, and you can hear it in his voice, but he also knows this stuff in his bones, even if it wasn't for him. And that degree of authenticity has served him very, very well in Texas politics. And as we can see in his presidential race, he is very much, quick to talk about his time on the farm. And he's trying to use that again. He's struggling a bit in this race, if we look at the polls and if we look at his debate performances, for a lot of reasons. But he wants people to know he's Rick Perry, who spent more than a dozen years working the land.
This is Focus on WILL-AM, and we're talking with NPR correspondent Don Gagne, who's in the studio with us on Thursday, October 13th, a pre-recorded program, talking about his work right now on the Republican presidential campaign trail. And it's not just covering the candidates. You're also talking to the rest of the people there, the people who are coming to see these candidates.
I am trying to talk to voters and the people who are actually going to be making decisions more than I'm talking to the candidates themselves. The candidates get plenty of time. They're giving speeches, they're doing interviews, they're doing all the debates, and I'm certainly covering all of that. But for me, the most valuable time I spend is walking up to people in small and large towns across Iowa, mostly small towns across mm-hmm. Iowa. I do the same in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Florida. And sometimes I talk to them at events, because when it's a speech or a town hall meeting that any given candidate is holding, then you get a member of the public who is particularly interested. Sometimes they've made up their mind, sometimes they haven't, but you can talk to them about why. You can talk to them about what they're hoping to hear, what they think about what they just heard. So that has real value. But there's also value in just walking up to people on the street and in the diner and at the state fair or wherever it happens to be. And just seeing how much the average person who you walk up to cold, who didn't think they might be approached by a reporter that day, is paying attention and what kind of things are on their mind. So that's all really valuable. And as we heard in that piece, again, these are real voices, you know, and the beauty of NPR is because we are a format that allows a piece to go 7 minutes or 8 minutes or 4 or 5 minutes, far longer than, you know, than you find elsewhere. You can let their comments breathe a bit, and you can not feel like you're hurrying to get them in so you can get on to the next story.
Well, with this being, I guess, campaign season number 4 that you've covered, mm-hmm. is there anything in just talking to people right now that stands out as to what their concerns are now to what they were in 2000 and 2004 and 2008?
I mean, certainly the economy is the first thing that comes up with the overwhelming majority of people. And in some ways, that's the same as it was in 2008. Because it was, you know, it was late September that the mortgage crisis hit and Lehman Brothers went through, you know, all of that. And that, you know, John McCain suspended his campaign for a while. And there was a meeting between Obama and McCain with President Bush at the White House, something kind of unheard of in a presidential campaign. So the economy was certainly front and center. But it's different now in that it is frustration that the hard times are hanging on and have been as persistent as they have been, that unemployment is still so high, that the jobs picture has not rebounded, to a far greater degree. That's the frustration you hear. The other thing, though, that is different is in 2008, there was no Tea Party. You know, the Tea Party was formed on tax day. During President Obama's first year in office in 2009. That's when they had the big rallies. And when I say it's formed, I don't mean to say there is like a Tea Party. There are all these little groups, and there's certainly a level of coordination nationally, but it is kind of there's not a leader for the Tea Party. So it's all these groups, but it's clearly a movement. So that makes it different, and that puts a lot of the focus, especially at Republican candidate events, on cutting taxes, on shrinking government, on all of that. And then there are certain places, you go to Iowa, where a large number of the participants in the Iowa caucuses last time on the Republican side self-identify as evangelicals. So they're fighting to keep social issues to the fore and not have it get drowned out by all of the talk and the concern about the economy. So you get that. And I was just in the past week at the Values Voter Conference in Washington, which brings conservatives, social conservatives, a lot of evangelicals, a lot of conservative Christians together for a big rally. And even there, not a rally, a conference, but even there, the economy is right in the mix of things they're talking about. So.
Do you feel that these people are finding what they're looking for in the lineup of candidates?
It's an open question at this point. And, you know, at this stage of the game, there has not been an actual vote cast.
The straw polls don't count.
Polls don't count. Those are they get a lot of attention because they do, and they can, you know, they can give you a sense of a campaign's organizational strength, or they can give you kind of a snapshot of what this type of event, what the people who attend an event like this are thinking at this moment, but they aren't real votes. And oftentimes the straw poll is at a convention where there's a $75 or $100 registration fee, you know? So that kind of winnows it down a bit. And you get the various campaigns paying for tickets for people to come to vote. And you see that at the Iowa straw poll as well. But what we're seeing in the polling is Mitt Romney holding relatively steady. He's always been in the top tier. Sometimes he's the front runner. Sometimes somebody's ahead of him. But in national polling, and this holds true if you look at the average of all polls. So it's not like this poll's an outlier or this one has questionable methodology. I mean, if you kind of look at the average of all polls, both the national polls and the polls in places like Iowa and like New Hampshire, Mitt Romney kind of holds in there in the low 20s, 23%, 25%. Which always gets him into the top tier, number one or two or thereabouts, in a crowded field.
At the same time, it seems that a certain core constituencies, the people in the Tea Party movement,
they do not like Mitt Romney.
Social conservatives are people, I should say, from evangelical Christian backgrounds.
They are distrustful of him either because of his past support for abortion rights. And, you know, his past, while he was governor, his belief that civil unions might be okay, you know. Now he says he is for the Defense of Marriage Act. Since his last run for president, including this one, he has called for Roe v. Wade to be overturned. He has portrayed himself as a strong pro-life candidate, but they are suspect because of, again, that thing about looking at the candidate's past. Then the thing that reared its head over the last week or so, again, that had been kind of quiet this time around, is the fact that he's a Mormon. And some evangelical leaders, particularly a pastor in Dallas, a Baptist pastor, said Mormonism is a cult and said Mitt Romney is a non-Christian, so true Christian voters need to take that into consideration. Mm-hmm. So you've got Romney still kind of holding steady, but clearly not winning the hearts of you know, a majority, enough of a majority where he can say, I'm the front runner, I'm the likely nominee. And the thing that has happened that I've never seen happen before is, you know, one minute Donald Trump is up in the polls, got to go back a ways, then he says he's not going to run. And then Michelle Bachmann is up in the polls, and then she has some gaffes and she stumbles a little bit, and Rick Perry enters and she suddenly fades fast, and Rick Perry is ahead in the polls. And then he has some problems in a series of debates, and a lot of conservatives have issues with his record on immigration. So he suddenly starts to fall, and now Herman Cain is up there. Herman Cain in the most recent polls as we sit here is actually in first place ahead of Mitt Romney. We'll see what happens. In the meantime, Newt Gingrich is waiting for his turn to get his boom, and Rick Santorum would love one, and Ron Paul would love one. But it has been so volatile that you have to be very careful even pretending to predict what's going to happen.
That brings to mind the whole horse race aspect of presidential campaign politics. And certainly a lot of the coverage I've heard has been, is it who's ahead now, who's mm-hmm. doing well in the popularity polls. And does this aspect of presidential campaign politics keep us from hearing about how candidates address or fail to address the issues? And how do you approach that when you're covering a story?
We do cover kind of trending poll trends. We don't cover every poll. We're not going, oh, no, now he's ahead. But if somebody like Herman Cain comes out of the blue, or if Rick Perry enters the race, we're not just covering him because he's suddenly ahead. We're looking at why is he ahead. And again, he's a governor of a big state, and he is a popular governor, and he has a story to tell about jobs that's going to be the centerpiece of his campaign. But what we have done, and we really do take this very seriously, is you try to spend most of your time getting at those very questions that you're talking about, kind of putting a reality check up against what they're saying, looking at their past, seeing where they're from, seeing who they are, seeing how different they are from what they say they are, or seeing if they've tried to reinvent themselves. We're doing all of that, and that is the truly important stuff. But the polling is not insignificant. You know, because the polling is not just a beauty contest. If it's done right, they are focusing on likely caucus goers in Iowa. They are, you know, looking at how someone is faring among New Hampshire Republicans who are likely to participate in the primary there. Certainly, there are national polls as well, and the candidates are able to use these polls as a way to demonstrate that they have strong support here, strong support among this chunk of the party, and they use it to fundraise. And their fundraising is, like it or not, a thing that enables them to stay in the race longer. It's the thing that allows them to run ads, the things that allows them to travel around the country. It's the thing that allows them to have much more control over how they get their message out and how they portray themselves.
Our guest
also lets them hire better consultants. You know, not to cut you off there. Sorry. Yeah.
Our guest this hour on Focus is Don Gagne of NPR News, who's been covering the Republican presidential campaign trail. But you've also covered a couple of White House administrations, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. And that certainly has to be different from the campaign trail because somebody's doing something.
It's very different. Your focus on the campaign is always it is about the contest. I mean, yes, you're looking at the issues. Yes, you're looking at where this candidate stands on this issue or what they propose and what the other candidate says on that particular issue. But the campaign is always you look at it through the filter of the election contest and how voters are responding. So it was, how does Senator Obama's health care plan look compared to Senator Clinton's? As soon as you how are Senator Obama's economic proposals different from Senator McCain's? And as soon as you get to the White House, it's how's this working? How are the things he is doing as president different from the things he said he was going to do as a candidate? How is Congress responding to these proposals? How has he altered these proposals in order to get them through Congress? And it is a very different equation, and you can measure success and failure in ways other than who won the election, you know, that first Tuesday in November. So.
The two different administrations you covered, what did they feel like? What was the difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration as you experienced?
There are certainly ways they are different. I mean, their view of government is different. And, President Obama has a more traditional Democratic view that government can be there to facilitate and to help people, and that government programs are not necessarily a bad thing. And President Bush had the more traditional Republican view that we should be trying to lower taxes, we should be trying to cut government, we can talk about things like privatizing Social Security. And so in terms of policy, they were very different, at least on domestic policy. They were not all that different when it came to kind of how President Obama looked at Iraq and Afghanistan going forward from the point that he became president. Now, certainly you can look back to how a President Obama, had he been in office in September of 2001, might have responded differently from how President George W. Bush did. And there are big questions as to whether or not we would have gone into Iraq and whether or not the focus would have stayed on Afghanistan. But President Obama, maintained Robert Gates as his defense secretary for a couple of years, and more than a couple of years, actually. And actually drew the ire of many of his liberal anti-war supporters because of the way he prosecuted the wars from that point forward. So in an issue like that, it wasn't a huge shift. But on domestic policy and things like that, they were very different. An area that they are not all that different was in their dealings with the press.
That's something I was going to ask about. What sort of access as a reporter did these two administrations give you?
A president and a president's staff and press secretary and communication staff are always trying to control the message and control the image and thus control the press. So access to the president was no easier under President Obama than it was under President Bush. And you still have, you know, kind of layers of people between you and the president who are trying to control the message every single day. And in that regard, there was more similarity than people would think. President Obama has maybe had a few more press conferences, but that doesn't mean that he's taken more questions. He has decided he likes to do, you know, interviews with, you know, the network TV anchors or whatever, more than President Bush did. But President Bush was more likely to, when he's got a foreign leader in the Oval Office for a meeting, take a few more questions over the course of the week, you know, kind of those shouted questions at the end of a photo op. But they share a great deal in how they try to control the message every single day and how the White House is viewed every single day.
Now, you were actually at the White House on September 11th, 2001. Is that correct?
I was. I was not there when the planes hit the Twin Towers. But I was the president, as people know, was in Florida that day. And he was giving an education speech and he was reading to kids at the elementary school. He was, you know, he was reading the book to kids when he got the news of the second plane, those famous kind of pictures, not just of the planes, but of him getting the news that we've all seen. So and because he had done a lot of education events like this and because we'd already been on the road with him for a number of them, NPR was not on that trip. So I had taken the opportunity to drop my daughters off at school a few blocks from my house. And I was heading to the White House when I got word of both the first plane and then the second plane. So I kept going to the White House, and it was as I was going through the security checkpoint and going through the initial gate that someone on the other side of the gate shouted, "The Pentagon has been hit." So I was kind of there for the evacuation. I was not actually inside the building at that point, but I was there to see the evacuation of the White House. And my path through security was aborted at the halfway point. So, and I was evacuated with everyone else.
And you must have been seeing reactions of people. This is the sort of events that was unheard of for everybody.
Yeah.
And you were, even though you weren't right there, you were very close to people who were having to deal with this.
Yeah, exactly. And again, the president and most of the key communication staff were in Florida. But there are, you know, dozens upon dozens of people who are working in the executive branch who are at the White House every day, whether the president is there or not. And you could see the evacuation, you know, people just pouring out of the executive, the West Wing and the main mansion as well, and out of the Eisenhower office building right next door. And the Secret Service were, they were clearly on high alert. I mean, that goes without saying. But you did not know what was happening. You did not know what was coming next. The administration officials who are out there on Pennsylvania Avenue with us, and then later in Lafayette Park as they push the perimeter back, and then later on E Street. I Street. They didn't know anything either. And people's BlackBerries, we didn't have BlackBerries yet. People's cell phones weren't working. There was just a total lack of information other than what you could see around you. And Yeah, I mean, it was a day I was out there for, I think, 12 hours, kind of, you know, that was kind of my perch.
You were having to file reports without really much to file on.
Exactly. And we would get some reports, some pool reports from the president as he was flying to, you know, Louisiana at a base and then to Nebraska and before finally coming home. But mostly all I could do, and it was important, was to just describe what I was seeing and what was happening where I was. And we had people at the Pentagon doing that, and we had people on Capitol Hill doing that, and we had certainly had a lot of people in New York City doing that. And it was a day that just kind of unfolded in a very, very both terrifying and surreal fashion. You didn't know what might happen next.
Well, I'd like to play a clip now from a report you filed really at the very end of the Bush presidency, looking back at 9/11, and it was a story that was called The Day That Defined a Presidency, and here's a clip from that.
That day, the president flew for security reasons to a base in Louisiana, then to one in Nebraska, before getting back to Washington that night, where he addressed the nation again, more formally, from the Oval Office. The public rallied behind him. Days later, he delivered a moving speech at a prayer service at the National Cathedral, and he traveled to Ground Zero.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people... And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
The White House went on war footing after 9/11. Tight security got tighter. Public tours were curtailed. Presidential schedules were less detailed. Secrecy flourished, all in the name of national security. Responding to the attacks, framing every policy in terms of the attacks, became the theme of the era. It's hard to overstate how different this was from what candidate Bush had foreseen. Less than a year earlier, in the final weeks of the 2000 campaign, George W. Bush described himself as promoting a, quote, humble foreign policy.
I just don't think it's the role of the United States to walk into a country and say, we do it this way, so should you.
Now compare that to what he told a joint session of Congress the week following 9/11 with this message to nations around the world.
Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
And, you know, listening to that, I realized that it takes a real effort to recollect what were the priorities of the Bush White House just before the September 11th attacks.
Mm-hmm.
This has defined his entire presidency.
From that moment forward, and in a lot of ways, it feels like so many stories. The majority of stories that I have done since have somehow been about that, even if they don't seem like it.
Even now,
on the surface, yeah, even now. Even now, sometimes.
How did it change? How much did the Bush White House change after 9/11?
Again, security and security in kind of very mundane ways was kicked up. I think I just heard it in that story. Like, it was just hard to get the daily schedule all of a sudden, you know, and they wouldn't release it till very late, or they'd only, you know, they distribute it on paper. And again, it was always said that, well, you know, for security reasons. We just don't want it, you know, disseminated the way it always has been. Presidential travel certainly got a lot more complicated. Every town he went to, and especially overseas travel. It was just not that there wasn't a lot of security beforehand, but it wasn't unusual to land somewhere, you know, on Air Force One, and to look out the window and see fighter jets landing alongside, you know, and you didn't see that before that. A motorcade might be driving along a canal somewhere, and you'd see, you know, heavily armed boats kind of racing along, you know, in the water, you know, 100 yards away, kind of keeping pace with you. And I mean, those are just some of the visible examples, and there were so many ways that we didn't see that it changed as well.
Has that continued into the Obama administration?
Yes. No, I have not been there in about a year and a half now, at least on a day-to-day basis as I've been doing the broader national political story. But I can tell you that the Secret Service presence and the level of security for this White House and the president and Air Force One and all things associated with the White House are at a far higher level than they were before 9/11. And again, we don't get a lot of operational details. We don't get any operational details. But I have heard just anecdotally that the Secret Service feels that their task of protecting the President of the United States has never been greater, and the resources they're pouring into it are certainly go along with that.
We're talking on Focus with Don Gagne of NPR News, correspondent currently covering the Republican presidential candidates, paying us a visit here in Champaign-Urbana on October 13th when we are recording this interview. And I apologize that we're not able to take your phone calls today. Don Gagne, I know you started reporting from NPR from the Detroit area. You're a native of that area. Mm-hmm. How did you get started in the business?
I started out in commercial radio, and I had always been a news junkie from the time I was a little kid, and I got that from my mother, I think. And we would, from my earliest days, and it started with watching the coverage of the Kennedy assassination when I was, in second grade. But I was always a news junkie and always kind of consumed by news and would always, frustrate my friends in high school and college by wanting to listen to the news on the radio instead of music or whatever, or more so than music. But I got my first job out of college. I had not thought of journalism as a career in college. I knew I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to be involved in the media. And I got a job as a country western disc jockey right out of school, and did that for a year, and was probably the worst country western disc jockey ever. But this was at a tiny little radio station in my hometown of Monroe, Michigan, which is just south of Detroit. And there was a guy in the newsroom who looked like he was having more fun than me. And he was covering the city council, and he was covering the nuclear plant that was in town, and he was covering the annual spring flooding and everything else. And he left after a year, and I moved into his job. And for the first time felt like, oh, I'm doing the thing that just kind of fits my interests and my personality, more so than the disc jockey thing, because anyway, enough of that. But again, this was commercial radio, and I was by then an NPR junkie, just like so many of our listeners out there. And I would go cover the Monroe County Commissioner's debate about some zoning thing related to the nuclear power plant. And I'd get back to my office at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night, and I'd have to get up and do the morning newscast the next day during morning drive. And I would think, okay, I have all this tape. I'm going to turn this into one of those stories that I hear Cokie Roberts or Linda Wertheimer do on National Public Radio when they're covering Congress. And I would build these, little 4 or 5 minute radio pieces, just mimicking NPR. And I'd play them on my commercial radio station the next day as part of my newscast. And I would do that with the local, there'd be a local concert or a local community theater group doing, Bye Bye Birdie or something. And I would try to do little NPR-style arts reports. And the long and the short of it being I was kind of unwittingly training myself for the job that I would get about 4 years later, which is the morning news anchor job at the Detroit Public Radio Station. That was 25 years ago, and I'm still here.
It's interesting to think about that with this clip I have here, which is from a piece you did from the NPR Lost and Found Sound series, I guess about 10 or 11 years ago.
I think this was, if it's the CKLW piece, it was probably 1999. So it was before I moved to Washington. I moved to Washington in 2001. And CKLW was the radio station I grew up listening to. It was one of those top 40, 50,000-watt clear channel screaming disc jockeys and Blood and Guts newscasts.
And apparently a very influential station. I once saw a TV documentary on it, but I don't think the TV documentary lingered on the news department the way this portion of your story on CKLW does.
Back then, every radio station did news, but nobody did the news like CKLW.
It's 20 minutes before 6. This is Grant Hudson, CKLW 2020 News. And there he was, the big, burly, hard steel-hauling man sitting in the cab of his rig on Van Dyke and Lance, crying.
The light had turned green for the little boy to cross the street. And as soon as it turned green, he jumped out into the street, and that the steel truck was coming pretty fast with the load of steel behind him and couldn't stop. And it came through the light and hit the little boy and knocked him about 15 to 20 feet.
You could not turn off that newscast. By the time you sort of locked into the fact that you were being conned into listening to the news, bam, it was over.
Accommodations are getting tighter at the Wayne County Morgue as officials stare at 16 new feet peeking out from under those rubber blankets. 8 murders since midnight, 3 of them happening a short time ago in an attempted quadruple blow-off.
The leader of CK's 23-man news team was a deep-voiced Canadian named Byron McGregor, who was still in his early 20s when he became news director and fine-tuned the station's signature news style.
I will say this, you know, radio is showbiz, let's face it. What it is a constant continuation of the exciting sound of CKLW. I mean, it's an exciting radio station to listen to.
And that was not the direction you went in radio journalism.
I did not.
I don't think anybody's doing that. And actually, listening to that clip, I wonder why.
It's you couldn't not listen. You couldn't not listen. And even when I hear that now, I'm 12 years old, you know, and listening on a little transistor radio, kind of transfixed by what they were saying. And that was a piece that we did for Lost and Found Sound, which was a year, maybe a year and a half long series that NPR did, capturing sounds that just don't exist anymore in our world. And some of it was certain kinds of train whistles or, you know, or fans or whatever it is. And the sound for me that was gone was the sound of this ever-present radio station from my youth. And we tried to recreate it. It was a 17-minute long piece.
And it must have been a challenge finding those air checks of CKLW.
It was, because when we did this piece, we were still working with cassettes, and a lot of the stuff that I found was on reel-to-reel, and this was all pre-digital. But there was and is a community of CKLW and Top 40, old Top 40 radio fanatics out there. I tapped into that network. And I had hours and hours and hours of stuff. And the hard part was whittling it down to try to recreate the sound of that station in an all things considered piece in just 17 minutes. I got more emails and letters for that piece than any piece that I had done in many years of reporting. And most of them were people saying, oh, you took me back to my childhood. But there were a few who wondered why such sound was coming from their speaker on their local public radio station.
Well, I want to wind up here. I wanted to ask you, you've taught some college journalism courses from time to time. So what sort of students are you finding in classes today, people who are deciding they want to be in journalism for a living?
There's one thing that hasn't changed is there is a certain kind of student who is drawn to this profession. And there are people who want to tell stories. There are people who are interested in the world. There are people who are willing to kind of take a risk on a profession that's very competitive and very difficult to get a toehold and then often hard to sustain. But the other side of it is that they're looking at the business in new ways. When I was taking, you know, the journalism classes I took way back when, you know, you were looking at newspapers, you were looking at television, and you were looking at radio, and that was it. And now there are just so many more outlets. We're all still trying to figure out, you know, kind of the business plan for it. luckily, the nonprofit business plan for that NPR uses works quite well with, you know, with the support from our member stations and from listeners and the like. But the thing that is consistent is you can just see the spark in these kids' eyes. They want to find stuff out. They want to learn stuff. They want to have a front row seat, and they want to tell stories. And that's what I try to encourage, because it's really been very fulfilling and fascinating and great fun for me. And I've had a front row seat for some real history.
So your quick practical advice for someone just starting out of the business?
Write. Listen to other writers on the radio and in other news media that you admire. But learn from others. Be critical of your own work and get your work out there. You know, don't wait for somebody to tell you to do something. If there's an interesting story in your community, go cover it. Write about it. Maybe it doesn't go beyond your journal, but if you can find a paper or a radio station to take your work, it's that little toehold that you need. And then if you really love it, keep at it, because there are a million reasons to stop doing it. You know, the pay is low, the hours are long, the deadlines are fierce, the editors are grumpy. There are a million reasons to quit. But if it's something you really love to do, just kind of work through all of that stuff, and the rewards come.
Well, Don Gagne, I've really enjoyed the chance to talk with you today on Focus. And I guess we'll be hearing you in the weeks and months to come on NPR.
I will be in New Hampshire, in Iowa, in South Carolina, in Florida, and more places than I can mention. Yeah, and hopefully bringing voices and people to you, you know, into your car and into your living room and into your kitchen that will make you think and maybe help you understand a story a little better.
Well, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you. They want to learn stuff. They want to have a front row seat, and they want to tell stories. And that's what I try to encourage, because it's really been very fulfilling and fascinating and great fun for me. And I've had a front row seat for some real history.
So your quick practical advice for someone just starting out of the business?
Write. Listen to other writers on the radio and in other news media that you admire. But learn from others. Be critical of your own work and get your work out there. You know, don't wait for somebody to tell you to do something. If there's an interesting story in your community, go cover it. Write about it. Maybe it doesn't go beyond your journal, but if you can find a paper or a radio station to take your work, it's that little toehold that you need. And then if you really love it, keep at it, because there are a million reasons to stop doing it. You know, the pay is low, the hours are long, the deadlines are fierce, the editors are grumpy. There are a million reasons to quit. But if it's something you really love to do, just kind of work through all of that stuff and the rewards come.
Well, Don Gagne, I've really enjoyed the chance to talk with you today on Focus. And I guess we'll be hearing you in the weeks and months to come on NPR.
I will be in New Hampshire, in Iowa, in South Carolina, in Florida, and more places than I can mention. Yeah. And hopefully bringing voices and people to you, you know, into your car and into your living room and into your kitchen that will make you think and maybe help you understand a story a little better.
Well, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Programs on WILL are made possible by the Illinois Professional Science Master's programs on the Urbana-Champaign campus, offering graduate degrees that combine science and business, including the program in agricultural production. More information is available at 217-265-5363 or on the web at psm.illinois.edu. Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square this Saturday morning at 7, with Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2319.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 1 minute before noon Central Time. Let's take a look at commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat, 704 and a half. That's down one. March, 719 and a quarter. Down one. December wheat, Chicago, 619 and three quarters, up one quarter. March, 652 and three quarters, up one. December corn, 641 and a quarter, up two and three quarters. March, 651 and a quarter, up two and three quarters. May, 657 and a quarter, up three. July, 661 and a quarter, up three. November soybeans, 1210 and a half, down 14 and a half. January, 1216 and a half, down 14 and three quarters. March, 1224, down 14 and a half. May, 1229 and a quarter, down 14 and a half. December meal, 316.60, down 270. December oil, 50.82, down 66. October live cattle, 120.80, down 60. December, 121.82 and a half, down 112 and a half. October feeder cattle, 138.92 and a half, down 27 and a half. November, 141.72 and a half, down 92 and a half. December lean hogs, 89.25. That is down